This episode is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. Become a patron today at patreon.com/intotheportal.
Darkness had washed over the Golden State as the reliable light of day faded into nightfall. The only time, it seemed, that peculiar objects would begin to appear in the skies. In the late 1890s across the United States, massive cigar-shaped airships began emerging from the clouds at great speeds and projecting powerful beams of light. Witnesses of these strange happenings experienced bewilderment, excitement, and even fear over who or what was piloting ships in the sky that would appear and disappear like phantoms. As news stories continued to break from state to state, speculations ran amok as to the true origins and possible landing locations of these mysterious craft. With every report, subtle variations in experience and description would emerge, from large wings and propellers to enormous flight decks projecting the sounds of singing crewmen in the clouds, and even a letter dropped from a supposed crew above describing harrowing accounts of a ship trapped in the skies, unable to land, as if stuck between some kind of sky realm and the earth below. With so many different individuals across vast distances describing these happenings, it leaves us to wonder, could accounts of these mysterious aerial nighthawks be linked to a single inventor? Foreign espionage? Or perhaps, in part, something paranormal? Join us on Into the Portal for part two, as we delve into theories and bizarre claims from coast to coast in an attempt to unravel the mystery of the Phantom Airship.
Hello, I'm Amber Ray.
And I'm Andrew McKay.
And welcome back into the portal.
Your gateway to the bizarre.
Today we're going to dive deep into part two of our airship series.
Indeed. Welcome back for the mystery of the Phantom Airship. And I'm really excited to get into the theories and some of the madness that quite frankly, we could have left out of some of the theories because it gets a little wild in some aspects. But there's also just the possibly an eccentric inventor angle. So many different things we're going to go through, but before...
You're listening to The Portal, so we're going to get into it all.
We are, indeed. Before we jump right into things, though, we haven't done housekeeping at the beginning of an episode for a while, and it might not be a theme we get back into, but I just wanted to give a massive shout-out to everybody who's left us a review, because I just haven't brought that up for a while, and I kind of saw a few new ones on Spotify and a few other places, so just wanted to give a massive shout-out and thank you to everybody who's left us a five-star rating and review, or, you know, any review, frankly.
Totally. Anyone who's pushed that subscribe button, we just really appreciate it. Anyone who's just mentioned the podcast, because that is still the number one way for a podcast, especially indie pods, to trend, because people don't know us. Yeah. We're not famous.
We are still a very small show, obviously, despite doing this for, like, 6 years now. So it really helps us grow, and just wanted to say thank you so much for that. And I didn't realize that actually on Spotify now, there is like a comment section. So
really?
People have actually commented on a lot of our individual episodes where it kind of prompted with like a generic question to say, hey, what do you think about this episode kind of thing? And I think I tweaked it last week. I think it's saved. So I kind of have a new Into the Portal themed question.
Okay, everyone go check it out. Listen to us on Spotify.
But thank you to everybody who's left a comment. I really appreciated that. And like one of them here was from like 22 days ago. Ben commented on our mermaid episode with Shay. I thought that was appropriate because we mentioned her a couple weeks ago. And I was like, ooh, maybe you guys should get into some interdimensional money-making evil mermaid stories from Africa, which our friends, the Kryptonaut Podcast, have delved into in the past.
Oh, so, I haven't listened to that episode.
Yeah, it gets weird.
I listened to their Devil on the Shoulder episode the other day at work. It was awesome. Yeah, those guys always have a good time.
Oh, yeah.
And I always have a good time with them.
It helps keep us inspired.
Totally.
Okay, so let's do a quick recap here before we get into all the stuff we're going to get into in part two. Part one, essentially, we were going through oddities in print for the most part. That was our main resource for a lot of these original newspaper accounts. Essentially, it was the accounts that started in the late 1890s.
And again, big shout out to our friend Adam Benedict.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Adam,
for providing the resource. The creator of this amazing, it's a wealth of stories that are just so fun. I love it.
Yeah.
And it just goes throughout the decades. It's very orderly. You know, he goes chronologically throughout time.
Well, he did the legwork for us on this one, right? Because all of these accounts were in order, as you say, and we could go into each one of them and be like, okay, how did this happen? And Amber traced it, obviously, from west to east. And so, yeah, we talked about, obviously, these accounts of dirigible-like cigar-shaped craft appearing and disappearing almost like phantoms in the clouds, sometimes hovering over large groups. Most of these sightings, if not all of these sightings, were at nighttime or in the dusk or dark darkness.
Seemed to have some sort of propeller feature, if not maybe wings or attachments of some kind in most cases.
And this was all before standard airship travel was at all mainstream. The Zeppelin patent hadn't been finalized yet. Commercial air travel with these types of ships wasn't... This was not a mainstream thing. This is obviously why.
I think the Zeppelin might have been... Actually,
it had been built,
patented.
It had been patented, but it was not.
It was in 1895. But we'll get into that because we're gonna actually cover a little bit more. I know we touched on it in part one, just a couple snapshots of actual examples of things, but we have a few more, so we're gonna touch on that too.
So obviously, just to kind of go through a few of the things here, we were talking perhaps foreign espionage from the skies above. We were talking about possibly the ideas of interdimensional phenomena, because maybe there's multiple different things happening here, because these sightings are popping up in vastly different locations across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then indeed, of course, the inventor, the secretive inventor, you know, landing a massive airship in some sort of like almost a James Bond-esque, you know, field somewhere, just some sort of clandestine, you know, research facility. Who knows? A lot to unpack here. So let's jump right into it.
All right.
Let's start off with the inventor stuff, because, of course, it was popularly believed that these airships were the product of some sort of, you know, early inventor, or at least an individual inventor, I should say. Not necessarily working for a company or the government, but just had the means and was building some sort of a steampunk-esque airship with wings, a massive light on the front. And just to touch on the light for a second here, too, Amber, you mentioned this in part one, but this technology was early. You know, the 1890s was obviously the era when electrification of everything was just starting to happen. Like, electric streetcars were coming into form in all the major cities in North America. Electric streetlights were just starting to become a thing.
Mm-hmm. Like,
in mainstream ways.
Electrically charged, but electric houses. What am I trying to say here?
Literally just
add light bulbs.
It's weird to think that not that long ago this was... Yeah, like that was a thing.
You still had
kerosene lamps, lighting streets.
Lanterns and all that.
Mm-hmm. Pretty wild stuff. So obviously a light that was projecting as far as the reports mentioned on the front of a dirigible craft would have been something quite expensive and quite hard to build, potentially, if you were an inventor just doing it yourself.
Indeed.
Pretty interesting. So obviously many historians and researchers think that this is possible, but they also suggest that it might have been difficult for just a single person or maybe two persons to build this craft. So the argument here is that they would have potentially needed some sort of a team. Maybe it would have been more likely that the word would have gotten out. There's an author named Rhys Gregory who's quoted as saying, "It has been frequently argued that mystery airships are unlikely to represent test flights of real human manufactured airships. Most skeptic reports on this case state that there is no record of any successful sustained or long-range ship air flights from this period." Now, Amber, you've probably got a bone to pick with that. But the point is, like, it obviously would have been really difficult for someone to build this on their own without the word getting out, especially in California, and then obviously pilot it all the way across the country.
Or halfway across the country.
Halfway, potentially.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there is a lot to digest with that sort of perspective, I guess. I do agree with it to a certain degree that, like, you know, there are no real record of these sustained, or like what we're being told in these stories, where it's like these types of speeds and these types of long range sort of like flights. Like there was a lot going on, and I'm not saying that it would have been impossible for this to be, but I get what he's saying there for sure.
I mean, you would have to be going 150 miles per hour if you were going to pop up across into these vastly different states, like, you know, to go from California to, I mean, it's a few days later, but
no, there was gaps. There was weeks, there was months. It started in the fall and it ended in April. So, like, you know, there was quite a range. And, like, you know, the more we look at these, I don't really want to draw any conclusions per se, but the idea that this could have been one craft seems to be less and less
likely.
Like, plausible, I guess, or likely, yeah.
Sure. Even though the feat, if that is indeed true, that is a feat, right? Mm-hmm. To obviously to go from east to west, or rather west to east, but to only be seen in sort of certain pockets popping up. Obviously, this nighttime travel would have been, you know, you're pretty secretive about it. You're going and you're flying over remote locations for the most part, because obviously otherwise you'd think you'd be seen in every state. You'd be seen everywhere as you're traveling with this thing.
Wow. The populations were a lot smaller. America's really big. Like, you know, like, I don't know.
But I mean, like, I think that's a pretty noticeable. That's a pretty noticeable. Yeah. That's, I'm sure you could be strategic. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and you're right in line with what a lot of people think. And a lot of these, here's another quote. A lot of researchers are essentially saying that, in line with the last quote I just said, it would have been impossible, not to mention irrational, to keep such a thing a secret. I think this is a little bit silly.
Would have been showboating. That would have been the more, like, realistic picture. I don't really think so, because I think there was a lot of competition over, like, especially, like, patents and technology.
I agree.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I agree with that one in particular.
I think maybe the idea with that is, like, yeah, just the era of... I mean, obviously people are still going to be secretive, but I guess it would have been... like the Edison Tesla era, where every invention's like, look at me, and they're beating their chest with like what they had just accomplished, you know what I mean, trying to one up the other person that's doing something similar to you. But
let's get into some examples of this, because like I actually did compile a few, like, you know, there was quite early examples. We're talking the 1600s. I know I mentioned that Francisco Lana de Terzi, who was an Italian, and he had this very unique concept of a vacuum balloon design.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So it kind of culminated after he published the book that we mentioned previously in part one, the Podromo, which was published back in 1670.
That's a ways back.
It is, yeah. And this contained a description for a conceptual flying ship. It wasn't really fully formed, though, and he allegedly continued to pursue his ideas. And 3 years later, he produced this design of an airship. And so this actually featured, this is a quote here, and it's actually from Wikipedia, which is a legit source for some stuff. You know what I mean? You have to follow up.
Yeah, we'll give a shout out maybe to Forrest.
Oh, there. Yeah, that's... No, it was Scott, actually. Scott. From Astonishing Legends, I was talking... I actually can't remember what episode it was, but he was mentioning how these days Wikipedia is actually more accurate than Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
So the next time you knock Wikipedia, just think about that.
Now, just to be clear, we predominantly use Wikipedia for the sources they have at the bottom, because actually a lot of the time you can find some juicy stuff.
Mm-hmm. So Terzi's design featured a central mast and four masts which had thin copper foil spheres attached to them. Picture that.
Interesting.
It's really weird. So the air would have been pumped out of the spheres, leaving a vacuum inside. And so being lighter than the surrounding air, it would provide lift. The airship would be steered like a sailing boat.
I love that.
And it would also have approximately room for 6 crewmen/passengers.
Interesting idea. I think maybe had a few issues, obviously.
It did. Well, it was impossible. And this was proven decades later in the 1700s.
The point is that 200 years ago, essentially, between the event we're talking about and this, there's at least a few steps in the direction of craft like this.
Exactly. And this wasn't the only guy that was thinking about these things. There was a lot of innovation, especially in the 1700s, culminating in the invention of the hot air balloon. And this was by two individuals, French innovators and brothers, that are known as Joseph Michel and Jacques-Étienne Montgolfier. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that one.
I think that sounds pretty great.
Sounds pretty good to me. It's actually cool because a montgolfier is actually now the ubiquitous term for the actual hot air balloon part.
Like interesting, really.
Would you call it a sail? I don't even know what you call it. The balloon.
The fabric part. The actual shape. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. Interesting, hey? So these guys have been immortalized in the airship balloon canon. That was when they made this history by launching. This is actually pretty funny. So they launched a sheep, a duck, and a rooster on a flight that lasted 8 minutes. And it traveled approximately 2 miles across the Palace of Versailles, which is an amazing, massive property,
sure.
Obviously.
Yeah.
And this was a feat that was witnessed by a crowd, including royalty. So we're talking Louis and Marie Antoinette. I can't remember. Oh my God. What is this one? Louis the 16th? I think it's Louis the 16th.
A sheep, a duck,
there's
and
an X, a
rooster.
A V, and an I there. So I think that's 16. So it was actually credited as the first ever flight to have a living creature aboard, or multiple living creatures, I guess, in this case. But I thought that was so cute. Could you imagine witnessing that?
Officially living creatures aboard a craft.
Yeah.
Happens to be farm animals, but
yeah,
that's really funny. And what a sight that would have been, obviously.
Yeah. Apparently there was actually, in and around the same time, there was another duo that I think they launched in and around Paris or something. And it was, I don't think it had sheep aboard. I think it actually had humans, which is kind of cool.
Good
too.
On you guys. Good
yeah.
on you.
I didn't actually include that in the notes, but I remember that little mention in my little nugget in my brain.
I
there,
mean, if they didn't explicitly say sheep were aboard, I'm guessing it was human occupants typically.
You'd hope, but.
Right. Mm. You know, this makes me wonder though, because obviously thinking of the hot air balloon, it's funny that we never actually really mentioned that in part one, just as a concept. You know, if you Google like steampunk airship, a lot of the time, you know, the fictitious designs and the renderings are essentially like multiple balloons, like, or a balloon at either, like picture a pirate ship with a hot air balloon at either end of it and then a propeller at the bottom, essentially, type of deal.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It kind of makes you wonder. I mean, obviously a hot air balloon is moving much slower and it's not going to be able to travel at speeds of 150 miles an hour with the shape it's in. I mean, you have to wonder if anybody ever tried that. Multiple balloons
there
on one,
a lot.
And then trying to get that to go fast.
There was definitely a lot of different ideas getting floated around, if you catch my drift.
Love it.
But yeah, no, not a lot was ultimately successful in the end for obvious reasons, whether it was just the fragile nature of the design or just some really strange ideas.
Well, and there's a hilarious Canadian example we'll get to in a second.
Yeah,
of a balloon-like, singular, more round-shaped balloon craft that, anyway, was an interesting ending to that, but we'll get to it in a sec. But now
but
we're
first,
bumping up to the 1850s.
Not quite here. So shortly after this incredible feat of the two brothers there that I mentioned, the Montgolfiers, shortly after, this guy, a French engineer by the name of Jean-Baptiste Meunier, he put forth his design for a 84-meter-long elliptical balloon, and this was powered by propellers. It actually featured a boat-like basket, and it was attached by ropes to the balloon itself.
So that is very much like what
I'm... kind of looks like it's just hanging there,
right.
Which is freaky to me. I would not get in that thing, to be honest.
In any of these so far?
No.
Obviously not.
Obviously not. This was never built, though, so that's kind of interesting. It was just a design. And the shape of this design, this dirigible, so to speak, actually has caused him to be known as the father of the modern dirigible, because he was the first to kind of like
that
succinctly
shape.
Come up with what we most often associate with airships.
Mm-hmm. The cigar, the general sort of cigar-shaped craft, which of course obviously comes up in a lot of other types of just sort of anomalous sightings in the sky. It's a sort of common shape of things, I suppose, and that might come up later.
I guess, yeah. I don't know. Is it?
A lot of UFO sightings are cigar-shaped.
Oh,
craft.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Oh, sorry. UFO specific. I thought you meant just like, well, I guess like airplanes too, from a certain angle, do look cigar-shaped too, because the wings are like invisible.
Exactly.
But anyways, let's get up to the 1850s here. And I believe we did mention this in part one, if I'm not mistaken, but the Gifford airship, we'll just quickly note this one here, because this was actually an interesting design, hydrogen-filled balloon, and it was powered by steam. And this actually did take flight, like we said, in 1852. However, it was not really the best to control, not ideal. And it certainly did not have the capabilities of these mystery airships or phantom airships that we've been describing in the part one of this series here.
So not as maneuverable, didn't necessarily have the massive light going on. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. But Gifford wasn't the only one with eyes to the sky. There was a couple other, these are just notable mentions that I found from an article in Lightspeed magazine. And this is a quote from the article here. It says, in 1852, Ernest Petain proposed a vessel of multiple balloons strung to a long horizontal scaffolding. Solomon Andrews, in 1860, built his Arion ship of three cylindrically shaped gas bags side by side.
So that's what I was kind of alluding to. So he tried that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, he tried it. And then in 1844, Alfred Bolt planned to mount two balloons to a long wooden cabin, one at either end. So that was kind of like what you were talking about there, which was to be steered by oars protruding from the sides and pushed forward by a propeller at the aft.
That couldn't possibly be described in more steampunk ways, as if you literally have rowing oars like on a ship on the water coming out the sides of your airship.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, all of this was just, there's a lot of convoluted efforts here, and none of them really rose to the top, the cream of the crop, so to speak.
No, and neither did this. Do you want me to get into the Canadian example? I'm just sort of jonesing to get into it. It's kind of hilarious, and it's a funny connection to the time frame of the original stories as well.
Yeah, totally. There was the whole effort of this, just before we get into that, was, like we mentioned at the top of the episode, there was the Zeppelin itself, okay? So we need to mention the Zeppelin before we dive into other things here. So in 1895, this was patented by two individuals, Ferdinand von Zeppelin, and it was actually built by David Schwartz, who was his partner. But it is notable to mention for the purpose of this episode that the inaugural flight of the Zeppelin did not take place until 5 years later.
Right.
And this was in Germany.
Right. And obviously the commercialization of the Zeppelin would have taken a few more years after that too. Like
yes.
Transcontinental flights mm-hmm. and things like this
Yeah. It's interesting. It was used in military applications for reconnaissance, surveillance, things like that. And then obviously there was the bougie era of Zeppelin airship flight. And that all kind of quickly wrapped up in the 1930s with the unfortunate disaster of the Hindenburg.
And it was one of the most iconic lines, quotes from a reporter, like, oh, the humanity and
sorry, I don't mean to laugh.
Well, no, I mean it's used in a lot of humorous sort of placements and
actually
stuff like
forgot
that, but
that was in that
that's where that footage. Sort of phrase comes from. And I'm always reminded of, and throughout the series and doing the research, and like the era of the fancy airship, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite scenes from the third Indiana Jones, where they're trying to sneak onto the Nazi airship, and then he ends up masquerading as one of the ticket holders, and he tosses a guy out the window, and all the people are looking at him. He says, "No ticket," and they're all like ripping their tickets out because they want to get thrown overboard. That's a great scene with Harrison Ford there.
Love it.
There is this really strange connection for us here at ITP to Canada with these early stories, and actually, throughout the 1890s and into the turn of the century, there were a lot of sort of phantom airship sightings in Canada as well, and also in Europe, too. This just happened to be one of the biggest, as Amber likes to say, flaps of the 1890s. But there was this funny, strange connection to Canada, as essentially people were scrambling for, supremacy of the skies. People wanted to master this, obviously, and hence all of these different wild designs that people were trying out. Originally, when the first sighting took place in Sacramento in Northern California, it was tied to a story in Canada where this inventor, who was Swiss-born, was attempting a flight that he probably wasn't quite ready to make the go of it. So it all began when an inventor by the name of André Knut Frankel and two other men attempted to use a hydrogen airship design and travel over the North Pole. They actually attempted to launch from an Arctic base called Slavbard, I believe it was pronounced, which is not an actual city or anything. Amber, you looked it up, and
it's
was essentially
settlement. It's interesting. It's like up north.
Temporary Arctic settlement at the time, kind of thing.
Not temporary. No, it was used by a lot of different colonist settlements. Like, because it had resources. It was used as a base to explore the Arctic. There was a lot going on there. Actually. Okay. Kind of interesting.
Anyway, this guy's design received a lot of scrutiny before he even attempted to take it off, to lift off with it, essentially. And it was dirigible-esque kind of a shape, but it did have a little bit more of a rounded, it almost looked like a turkey baster, kind of the end of a turkey baster, where it's like heading in that elongated sort of shape direction, but it had a little bit more of the balloon, and then that would be propelled. people were not super thrilled about his design, or at least other inventors, but he was convinced that this was going to work. And this is the connection to Canada here, because he ended up crashing in essentially what would have been northern Canadian territory.
Really?
Because it only lasted a few hours. They launched in July of 1897. Hmm. So interesting, right in around sort of the same time.
Yeah.
Obviously a few months off here, but the story would lead to the speculation. So they lifted off and almost immediately lost hydrogen and crashed into the ice pack after a couple of days, rather. They lasted 2 days, not 2 hours is what I meant to say. Mm-hmm. 2 days. Pat on the back. Pat on the back for these guys. In 1897, in the Arctic, of all the places to do it. Like, why not try the Caribbean or something?
I know, right? That's dumb.
Because obviously people were fascinated with the North Pole.
Yeah.
Fascinated with exploring the Arctic. These ideas of, a hollow earth even potentially. Mm. Or like caves and gateways to other places. It was an undiscovered place.
And I think also a big aim too was to try and establish some way of passage over the pole as opposed to having to go over the ocean.
Right.
Like that was a big thing that people were kind of like thinking about.
Absolutely. Mm. But this is why it ended up being a part of the story, because essentially what happened, nobody knew that that's what happened after 2 days. They crashed into the ice. This is obviously an era where you don't have any sort of GPS or any sort of communication
no
technology.
Radio on board.
And so essentially they were left in a very similar position as the Franklin expedition, mm-hmm. frankly, pun intended, I suppose, Franklin, frankly, but mm-hmm. they essentially were in the middle of nowhere on pack ice.
Mm-hmm.
They were completely unprepared because he was convinced that his flight was going to be successful. And their only hope was essentially to try to make the trek back the way they came.
Yikes.
Because that was the closest possible human habitation. So essentially 33 years went by without anyone knowing the fate of the expedition, because nobody had gone to find them.
Wow.
And so this led to later speculation that perhaps somehow, some way, this team, I guess, was successful, landed somewhere, evolved his idea, and then continued to fly around the United States, starting with the sighting in Northern California.
Hmm.
So that's the connection to Canada, not a Canadian inventor, but
no.
in the Canadian Arctic, where these men unfortunately perished, froze to death.
That's very unfortunate. Yeah, 33 years, and then they were discovered. Eh? Oof.
Yeah.
Woof.
So very similar to Franklin, and that's again.
I'm curious, like how long this Andre guy thought the flight was going to be. I'm curious how much time he gauged.
Yeah, thought he could get it done in a couple of days. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. But you know what? I think we need to come back to one of the most fascinating and certainly for me compelling potentially stories that we touched on in part one. And that was the story of the dropped letter,
mm-hmm.
the ship trapped in the sky and one Samuel Hagen, if he actually exists or not. So we need to get into that.
Oh, totally. Yeah. The cry for help from Samuel Hagen and his unnamed assistant. Yeah, so we were trying to dig around, and we found a reference to a Samuel Hagen in a wiki tree that stated he was born in Pawling, Georgia of 1853. He was the son of Henry Hagen and Elizabeth Stewart, but there is a small hitch with this.
Mm-hmm.
Allegedly, he did pass away before the time of the flap that we're talking about in this episode,
right.
And it's kind of unfortunate. He was only 19 years old, so it's in the record as 1870 as his death date, but did he die? We don't even have a location or a burial for him.
No, there's like almost no information. It's literally kind of just names and dates, and obviously the name matches. But yeah, like, is this an incorrect publication of a date? Is this even the same person at all?
Mm-hmm.
Or did they fake their death because they are some sort of an eccentric inventor of some kind trying to go off and do clandestine things?
Yeah.
Who knows?
But off you did. Off grid, man.
Off grid. Mm-hmm. You did find a pretty fascinating potential connection, though.
I know. I thought this was interesting, and maybe this is just fun food for thought, but his mother, Elizabeth Stewart, allegedly was connected to one Ferdinand von Zeppelin, 21 degrees of consanguinity, which is just referring to the closest familial connection or common ancestor. So I thought that was just kind of a fun fact. Like, you know, like we mentioned Ferdinand von Zeppelin at the top of this episode, responsible for none other than that design that we're all familiar with. But I don't know. What do you think, Andrew?
I think that is more than just a little bit of a coincidence. I mean, we're talking about airships. This is before the official launch of the Zeppelin, and there happens to be a name connection to Samuel Hagen. That's pretty interesting to me.
I know, right?
And, you know, obviously the date doesn't match for the death, but But you and I were also talking about this off air. It's like the name Samuel Hagen, especially back in the 1890s, wasn't exactly a rare, you know, the name Samuel for sure. It was not a, not an uncommon name. That's for sure.
No,
I mean,
definitely
Samuel
not.
Adams Beer. Let's all, right. I mean, it's, yeah. it's, it could be the same person, but yeah, it's, there's a lot of crossover here potentially.
Oh yeah. And just a lot of ambiguity. And one final thing that we should mention is that we did not find any information that Samuel Hagen, whether it was this Samuel Hagen or any other Samuel Hagen, any information to support the claims in the letter that he was a wealthy individual, quote unquote, that was able to put up this reward money in return for his rescue.
Correct.
So yeah,
there was also, you know, nothing went any further to say, for example, you know, taking the letter that was allegedly dropped and then, you know, finding any records of whatever this one Samuel Hagen or even family records and being like, you know, what does this match? Is like, is there any sort of matching in the writing style? Does it match the education level? I don't know. Like, whatever it may be. Like, is there some sort of potentially clues within that? But that nobody really went down that path. I mean, where is this letter, right?
We don't know. We don't know if there was any investigation because it was largely taken as like a hoax slash a joke by a lot of people. And it wasn't until from the earnest of the other people that witnessed it, that people maybe started to look at it a little more seriously. But we don't have any more follow-up, so that's unfortunate. And we don't even ever learn the name of his companion. So if he had named him in the letter, then maybe we would have more things to follow up on. But alas, here
we are. Was it deliberately vague, or was it just in haste of trying to drop anything at all and not naming them? And I love the idea of a ship just being still to this day, trapped in the sky. That's something pretty spooky.
Oh man. Well, I'm sure they would have crash landed by now.
At some point. Sure.
But you know what's interesting? We actually had another individual who claimed to be the culprit behind the airship sightings. I thought this was fascinating. A San Francisco attorney, George, quote unquote, Airship Collins, claimed to represent an anonymous inventor who allegedly was conducting test flights at night in order to avoid detection. So kind of what the original theory was postulated in one of the very first articles we read. But according to George Collins, the airship that his client was responsible for was, it fit the description, it was about 150 feet long and able to carry a load of 15 passengers, which might have explained the noise, the merriment, the dancing that we heard in that one account, and the arguing, I guess, as well. So it's interesting here. He actually told the press, quote, "It was built on the aeroplane system and has two canvas wings 18 feet wide and a rudder shaped like a bird's tail."
So taking inspiration from the early early designs that hadn't even really come into effect yet.
But. Yeah, exactly. But unfortunately, he was never able to produce the mysterious inventor or his craft. And so growing tired of quote unquote public ridicule, he later recanted his claims. So maybe he just regretted coming out into the open. He had nothing to support him. So
interesting.
I know, right? What do you make of that guy?
I mean, I obviously can't stand it when people do that and backtrack on things. That, I mean, the fact, did he nickname himself Airship Collins?
Or
was this some sort of, like, colloquial in the city, in the region he was from, it was given this, like, that's...
Yeah, or from the press, maybe, or...
I feel like this guy's probably not the culprit. I think certain people probably were looking at the... What's the word? I mean, the hype, obviously, around these stories when it was going coast to coast, and maybe wanted to just sort of, you know, get in on it and take some credit for it, even if it wasn't associated at all.
Maybe trying to gain notoriety for his firm or like, you know,
get some investments, right?
Well, yeah, exactly.
I mean, talk about a publicity stunt if you actually do come out after the fact, because this is, you know, spreading across all of North America. This story was, you know, in the Associated Press up into Canada, and people were very interested in what was happening here.
Yeah, it was an event.
And I'm sure they would have been even more interested if there was any further proof to suggest that this might have not just been someone who was creating something and flying across the country, but were actually doing it deliberately for potentially a foreign government.
You never know. Or maybe, yeah, exactly, like the inventor that's actually contracted by a foreign agent or government or organization or whatever, like a specter.
I mean, we can no. I think that's something we should probably explore.
I wonder. Well, we do have this story that's kind of speaking to, I guess, a little bit along those lines, a foreign reconnaissance, perhaps espionage. We're not really sure, but this actually was taken from Oddities in Print as well. I you know, I love skimming through that book, and when I found this particular one, I thought it was definitely relevant.
Needed to be mentioned for sure.
It does take place years later, though. So it's not in the same time frame. It's not the 1800s anymore. We're talking 1908 in the Tacoma, Washington / Puget Sound area. And this was actually titled "Must Have a Vivid Imagination." And it goes as follows here. It was reported in Tacoma in February 6th of 1908. Quote, "For several evenings, strange red and green lights have been seen at high altitudes in Tacoma, Kent, and other places along Puget Sound, as far south as Gray's Harbor. Yesterday, while a Pacific train, a Northern Pacific train, was waiting for a drawbridge in the Tacoma Yards, the engineer saw a strange object, very big, in the air, and somewhat obscured by the heavy weather." "He called the conductor's attention, and finally, several passengers saw it. Tourists who had field glasses declared the object to be an airship and said it carried a Japanese flag."
Okay.
Yeah, a Japanese flag carrying spies who are studying the coast topography is the firm belief of many people. Okay. End quote. Yeah, so is this a plausible explanation?
So it's not is in it, the... Yeah, I mean, that's...
It's on the right coastline to me. It's on the west coast. On the coast, right coastline. So.
It's about a decade later, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean...
Could this be, like, you know, like, could this explain our earlier flappers to something else entirely? I wanted to look into whether or not the Japanese had such technology at the time, if they were pursuing that. It was still Imperial Japan at that time.
Right.
And they were in the heyday of modernization, and this was including rapid industrialization. They had very strong imperial military ambitions, and this was tied to the emergence of modern nationalism, loyalism to this empire. And it's interesting because they were more so focused on two sort of realms, I guess, the domestic realm and then the military realm. And they would have led with caution with such new technology is kind of in my brief armchair research here. And, you know, like, we've obviously been, we've had through our degrees had exposure to historical of early Japan here. But it's interesting because they had a lot of, like, a wait and see sort of mentality with, you know, approaching new technologies such as airship technology and things like that.
Interesting.
They would have seen it useful, obviously, for reconnaissance, military aims, things like that, and scouting. But they were not, a leader in this realm. So also, it's kind of questionable, yeah. But they may or may not have had the ability.
And that's a journey. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like, where you're presumably would be launching this from a ship, because you're not traveling from Japan to do this sort type of reconnaissance, if that is what this was. I think that this is, though, even 10 years later, potentially evidence of this in the late 1890s, because it was either potentially, like, one, inspiration to do so, whether or not the first few sightings were linked to any sort of espionage or type of reconnaissance from even Canada, like, from any sort of foreign government, thinking like Murdoch mysteries type stuff here.
Yeah.
Or was it something that foreign entities could have seen in the papers and known through their own channels that, yes, this was in fact some sort of thing they wanted to mimic. This was someone succeeding in some sort of spy reconnaissance, and now here they are 10 years later potentially trying to mimic it, maybe less successfully, maybe more successfully, who knows.
There was no follow-up again on this particular, but it is kind of fascinating to think that perhaps the Japanese were making incursions into American territories. I think that is fascinating to think.
And oh yeah. definitely interesting historical piece there.
Provocational.
Indeed. And that's actually kind of a good transition here, even though we are heading into a little bit more of the paranormal realm of some of the theories and definitely the conversations online associated with the airship mystery. And that is the idea of a different type of reconnaissance, a different type of cloaking or potentially trying to sort of be hidden in plain sight to survey the United States. And this is the suggestion that potentially at least some of these sightings were extraterrestrial craft that may have been trying to mimic technology they thought was matching the time. And this is something we've talked about on episodes before. It comes up a lot in UFO circles, and it seems to be quite plausible that a lot of the sightings that we, you know, that we encounter are potentially things that aren't man-made and are indeed something else trying to look like something. I think that's why I think that sort of matches up with the idea that this wasn't quite exactly on the timeline of the Zeppelins and of these dirigibles being that common.
Okay.
So that could come in line with something being, it's like, okay, they think they're right on time. They think they're mimicking the right thing.
They're almost there.
But in fact, they're a couple of years off.
Yeah, we get that quite common, hey? The idea that people witness things in the skies that are maybe 10, 15, 25, 50 years advanced.
Exactly.
And then eventually we catch up in the mainstream.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of two aspects of this. We've said it, but just to kind of just clarify it. So it's like, they would be surveying the United States, presumably for various different reasons that are unknown, and then masking as a technology that they think makes sense for the era, but is still a little bit too early. Or two, the craft is being misinterpreted by witnesses because they don't know anything about... I mean, this is pre-UFO era, right? Mm-hmm. This is pre, you know, obviously pre-Roswell, pre-Kenneth Arnold. This is before, you know, it was common for people to see the classic flying saucer shape in the sky.
And quite often, if there was something mysterious seen in the skies, it might have been interpreted under a different lens, like perhaps even a religious lens.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
And we touched on that in part one. I mean, people were freaking out. They thought it was the end of days, potentially,
exactly,
because there were
these
ships. It almost reminds me a little bit of going back to, way back to our... Lost gold, Montezuma's gold story, and, you know, obviously the early Spanish showing up, and I think that was conflated and blown out of proportion a bit, but this idea that these ships were something much mightier than just wooden vessels floating, and that they were actually, you know, godlike entities, you know, showing up on the shores. Kind of a similar vibe here with the airships, depending
perhaps,
on what your perspective is.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually do have a couple of cases that corroborate this potentially, or at least are correlated to the idea of UFOs, because they match up with the timeline. And we have a very interesting story from November of 1896 that we actually came across for the very first time doing research for this episode, and it might in fact be the first ever alien abduction attempt in the United States, at least on record, which is pretty interesting. Had to be mentioned because here we are in Sacramento, 1896. So we are right on line with the first set of sightings that took place in Northern California.
Totally, yeah. So the first set of sightings, yeah, that was Sacramento. It was the San Francisco Bay Area. And then this case takes place just 50 miles north in a town called Stockton.
Not very far away.
Yeah.
Especially if it's an aircraft. So it goes as follows. We're going to kind of break this down for you guys. The Stockton Evening Mail published on November 25th, 1896, a story that read, "Seen on a country road by Colonel H.G. Shaw and companion, something strange." There was a few other different variations of this title, but essentially the story goes that a man named Colonel Shaw was traveling by horse and buggy with another companion named Camille Spooner. Like a lot of the original sightings we talked about, it was dusk. We're heading into nightfall here. This is not a daylight sighting.
Okay.
But the case goes that Colonel H.G. Shaw was driving his buggy through the countryside, 50 miles north of where the first sighting took place, and came across something unbelievably strange. He was quoted in the article saying, "We were jogging along quietly when the horses stopped suddenly and gave a snort of terror. Looking up, we beheld three strange beings." He's just getting right into this. There was no beating around the bush here. There's three strange beings standing right in front of them. He says, "They resembled humans in many respects, but still, they were not like anything I had seen before. They were nearly or quite 7 feet high and very slender."
Ooh.
This is matching up with a lot of different...
Sounds like some grays.
Yeah, slender, tall. "These beings wore no clothing. They were covered in a natural growth hard to describe. It was not hair, neither was it like feathers, but it was soft as silk to the touch."
Weird.
And immediately I had to put a note in here. It's like, he's just copping a feel right away. We're not...
just like reach out and touch
them. I mean, like, because, you know, he didn't say like, "Oh, we pulled right up to them." Like, "Oh, I saw three strange beings and just pulled up in the buggy 1 foot away and I stuck my hand out and copped a feel." That is just fascinating, but we can continue.
Colonel Shaw. Wow.
"They seemed to take great interest in us, the horse and buggy, and scrutinized everything very carefully. Each alien, quote unquote, carried a shoulder bag attached to a nozzle. Every little while, one of the other would place the nozzle in his on its mouth, at which time I heard a sound of escaping gas."
Interesting. So they're like, they have their own little augmented atmosphere or some way of breathing?
It's almost as if they are able to breathe. Like, that reminded me immediately of, like, divers, right? Where you can breathe oxygen, but you need to supplement it with another type of gas because whatever the composition on Earth would be, you know what I mean? Like helium.
Oh, because of the pressure, you mean? Potentially. There's pressure changes. That's interesting.
And that's why they would reach up and only do it every so often, because they can technically breathe oxygen, which is maybe, I don't know.
Or maybe they just breathe really slow.
Or maybe they just breathe really slow.
I don't know.
But this, honestly, that isn't even the weird part. This is where it gets extra weird.
So according to Shaw, there was some kind of object that these beings were moving around. However, it wasn't totally visible due to, obviously, it being dusky, dark, whatever. But apparently, there were, a quote, this is a quote from him, he said, lights that appeared to be made of some sort of luminous material. And then these beings revealed a startling, immense airship that was hovering nearby.
And he described it as an airship.
He did, yes. He also went on to say that the vessel itself was roughly 20 feet in diameter and 150 feet long. So we are getting basic matchup to what we've been describing before.
Yes, we are.
This is interesting, though. He does go on to say it had a metallic outer surface, and other than what appeared to be a rudder, it was completely devoid of any extra external features.
Right, okay.
So that doesn't really, like, you know, the winged things that some people were, but who knows, maybe those actually come out when it's flying. So Shaw approached these beings, and he even felt compelled to reach out and see what they felt like. So this is where we get the little cup and a feel.
So he was compelled to do
so. He was compelled. They were just so alluring to him. And he claimed he actually placed his finger under the arm of one of these creatures and lifted him up, only to find that he was lighter than an ounce. So these things, again, I feel like it's almost as if these things are floating in the air. Like, the composition of our atmosphere is a pressure differential that makes them actually lighter. It's almost like when we would go to the moon, we'd be like, the gravitational pull, and, like, I don't even know.
It's
almost, I'm not a scientist.
They're like a scientist, alien scientist. That sounds so ethereal.
It does.
It's like, it's almost as if they're there, you know, they're, yeah, like, their composition is just, like, just part of the matter that would normally be required with, like, the gravity on Earth or something.
I know,
like,
right?
That also kind of lends me, that makes me think about the idea of zero point energy too, and, like, non-ballistic motion.
Oh.
Not that we saw this with these craft, but just thinking about alien craft, if you weigh that much and your body composition isn't, like, at, you know, solid like ours, then you think, like, that non-ballistic, like, immediately going from 0 to 3,000 miles per hour isn't going to affect you, because you're not, like, a physical being that's going to get crushed by that pressure.
Not only that, but you're not weighing down the ship like a heavy anchor would. You know what I mean? Like, you're just, like, this gelatinous, I don't even know, just this ethereal thing. But he actually goes on to further describe these beings, and this is a quote from Shaw. He says, quote, their faces and heads were without hair, the ears very small, and the nose had the appearance of polished ivory. Their mouths were tiny, while the eyes were large and lustrous. So this is a very classic, like, alien description here.
Very much like the grays.
Mm-hmm, totally, those huge eyes. Like, this is, yeah, very, very just quintessential here. And allegedly, these creatures then attempted to force him on board, but failed somehow, and gave up, apparently gliding over to their craft, where once they were inside, it, quote, sprang up 20 feet, and the aliens whizzed off. It went through the air very rapidly and expanded and contracted with a muscular motion and was soon out of sight. That almost sounds like a lung breathing, or like a jellyfish, or like a cuttlefish moving through water. You know how they, like, go, and then they just take off, and it's like, holy moly, how did you just, like, you know?
So this is like organic matter ships.
Yeah.
Potentially.
It has a metallic appearance at one point, and then, yeah, it just, like, transitioned somehow.
And, of course, this is why not only is this story just absolutely fascinating and the dates match, but this aligns with the idea of cloaking. The idea of these ships potentially being reconnaissance over the states for whatever reason. They're just interested. I mean, this is pre-nuclear weapons. This is pre-many things that we believe extraterrestrials to be interested in. But here we are still potentially seeing cloaked craft. I think that is a real possibility.
I think it is too. I really, there's so many similarities, right? The shape, the size, the location of the sighting, The idea that there's like a crew like manning this ship too. Like there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot to kind of align it with that. There's also some, well, maybe if you want to buy into that cloaking sort of like disguise sort of feature, like I'm trying to think, like, cause there was that account that described distinct voices and like sounded like human voices and like speaking in English. So I'm like, I want, maybe it's just like a track that they play.
They're flying over. They just have a tape recorder. Not
we're human. Yeah. No need to pay any mind to us. You know?
All good. We're just singing. We're just singing at night in a giant airship. No big deal. Totally normal.
It's very interesting, but I think the size and there's, I don't know. I just keep going back to like the general shape and descriptions. Like, and I'm curious if this Colonel Shaw would have seen the headlines from the other, like the Sacramento and Bay Area, like, you know, just, it was just a few days prior. So I'm curious if he had any exposure to that.
And very much like so many episodes, and in part when we mentioned this too, just a classic two-letter first name.
Mm-hmm.
G.E. Kincaid, H.G. Mm-hmm. Shaw, you know, S.W. Hagen, S.E. Hayden. Like, it's so difficult to track these individuals down.
It's impossible. Yeah.
We have to take it with a grain of salt, but it is really interesting that it aligns. Mm-hmm. And we do have another as well that potentially aligns with the second set of sightings that we discussed heading into April, just a few months later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second one we touched on in part one was in Oklahoma. There were obviously sightings across the country in many different states. It wasn't just California and Oklahoma. We got all the way to the
East
Coast.
Great Lakes area.
But here we are on April 17th. And this is another classic in UFO lore that we just had to mention for this airships episode, where there was an alleged crash, very much like the crash at Roswell in 1897 in a small town called Aurora in Texas. So this is obviously miles away, but again, April 17th, this is definitely in and around the same time that second set of sightings was taking place in this sort of areas of the country. The story goes like this. Again, early hours, so we're not in the full light of day. This is like just starting to get to daybreak here.
Mm-hmm.
The early hours of Saturday, April 17th, 1897, allegedly, there was a strange object, unknown shape, that streaked across the sky, but apparently from, quote, witnesses that we only don't really have any, like, specific ones to go off of for the story, saw it flying that presumably was off kilter. It looked like an object that was in distress, flying off kilter, and it's allegedly hurtled wildly over the town of Aurora and crashed directly into the windmill of a man named J.S. Proctor, who was apparently a judge in Texas. Right. Now, the craft and this poor judge's mill were completely obliterated. The impact was so great that it was absolutely destroyed. It mangled this quote-unquote ship, but what was left was this combination of debris that looked to be a mixture of aluminum, silver, potentially other types of metal that are obviously unknown in the 1890s, and allegedly had hieroglyphic-like drawings scattered across of these materials. Now, I don't know if this is hieroglyphics showing on the outside of the craft before it crashed, or if this is something on the inside that was, you know, instructions or something else. Like, I don't actually know, but that definitely sort of struck a chord, because we've talked about cases before where there's alleged hieroglyphics on alien-left objects and things like that.
Yeah, whether it was like a crashed object or there was that one story about the tablets that had those strange hieroglyphs. I think that might have been proven to be a hoax, so I can't remember
the details, but it was a little murky to the end, but that was also in Texas. I believe that was in our Big Bend National Park episode.
Correct me if
I'm wrong, listeners, you can hit us up. But then there was also the Ketchburg UFO.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Which we haven't actually covered specifically.
No, we haven't.
But that, there's actually a model of it on a stand, and it depicts essentially an acorn-shaped UFO craft that also has sort of hieroglyphic-like markings on the outside.
And that was the case where something crashed in the woods in behind Ketchburg, and then the military was on site within, like, minutes, if not, like, you know, like, very shortly after, right? If I'm remembering correctly. And then someone saw it being transported away. And that's where it's like in a town square, isn't it? The statue?
It's like off the highway close to the center of town or something, like as you come in type of thing.
Oh, just like a classic highway side attraction.
It's kind of like, I feel like the you know, the Mothman with the big padonkadonk now. And little bit of a famous part of the city's
that's
history.
That's awesome, though, that they commemorate it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, let's continue on here. So this was a quote from an article article, or well, from the newspaper publications the following day. There were witnesses. I guess, obviously, it's a small town in Texas. People are getting up early to do their farm chores, probably.
Probably, yeah.
Would have seen this type of thing. Oh, yeah. So the article says, quote, "An otherworldly airship crashed in Aurora over the weekend. When the locals investigated, they found metallic wreckage which looked nothing like they'd ever seen before. Mm-hmm. Amidst the wreckage, the body of the pilot was found. He looked like no one they'd ever seen on Earth, period. The townsfolk, after careful consideration, decided the pilot must have come from Mars."
No friggin' way, man.
Okay.
Where is this pilot? Where's this body now, being stored?
This is a very big grain of salt that needs to be taken with this, yeah. But this does also have a very striking similarity to, obviously, the later crash at Roswell in the 1950s, where this is essentially the exact same thing happening.
Well, okay.
Sans military response.
When was this originally? So there was a newspaper coverage in the 1800s, or was this something that was fabricated later on and then applied to an earlier time frame? I'm curious now, because there's so many parallels to the classic Roswell story.
So we can share this link with you guys. There is, whether or not it's a repop or it's some sort of a associated, like yellow journalism associated press type story, mm-hmm. is up for debate and speculation.
Okay.
Very much like our Angie Cooney Lake mystery, where we knew some of those articles from the Associated Press were legit. Mm-hmm. And then there were others juxtaposed to them where it was like a little dubious. Mm-hmm. We're in the same position here for sure, because there's another name tossed in here, if you will, that is extremely difficult to track down. So the corroboration was coming from one Mr. T.J. Weems, who I, just preliminary armchair Google search, and like the name Weems does come up as associated with the U.S. military, because allegedly this guy in the 1890s was an Army Signal Service officer in Texas.
Hmm. Okay.
He was the closest person to the alleged crash site to take a look at this, because there was potentially an extraterrestrial associated with it, to give his opinion.
Hmm.
And apparently this is where they pulled the quote for the newspaper article, because this guy is the one who said, this must be a native of the planet Mars.
Specifically Mars, because we know exactly what they would look like.
Is this just because, like, in the 1890s, that was, like, was the red planet just extra famous in the 1890s? Probably. Was that the thing?
I don't know. It would have probably been one of the most prominent in the night skies. Right? And
but the concept of Martians, I don't think, had necessarily a few decades early for that.
It does. That strikes me as more of the 1950s era of, the classic, UFO explosion type. Yeah, no, I'm not sure. But again, like I was saying, maybe this is something that's been kind of backdated and was written a little bit more modernly. Is that a word? I don't know.
But a more current take on things. Yeah. Obviously, you guys, this is one that's really just really for fun and mm-hmm. just, fascinating to speculate on. I think the Colonel Shaw one potentially has a little bit more credibility to it, if you will, because the story continues on here that this Mr. T.J. Weems essentially was the one who helped pull the body out of the wreckage and retrieved records on his person. This entity was allegedly traveling with essentially a intergalactic passport that this guy used to, come to the conclusion that he was a Martian.
And
it was written in the same hieroglyphics that were on the craft, like the same type of strange lettering.
Where was his Rosetta Stone for this? How was he, how are you deciphering this? And what? I'm very fascinated. I want to see this intergalactic passport that this alien pilot had.
Yeah.
This is a lot to take in.
It's a lot to take in. He did continue the rest of his investigation, supposedly, and was unable to figure out any sort of power source on the craft. The wreck was so badly damaged that it was indiscernible as to what was powering this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of just went quiet after this. Hmm. The rest of the airship flap sort of took over, I guess, because this didn't really seem to become a big thing in later UFO circles until the 1970s. This was actually picked up, by researchers poking through all kinds of different yellow journalism type articles trying to find real and not real. Mm-hmm. And in 1973, it was picked up by UFO investigators, and they actually went looking for the original site. They were using newspaper reports to kind of triangulate exactly where this happened in Aurora, where J.S. Proctor's windmill might have been.
Mm-hmm.
And so allegedly they went back there And there was a headstone. I mean, I'm saying they. There was no names. This is just, you know, many different researchers on in the 1970s. And on MUFON, there is reference to this story.
Okay.
And so they went back there in the 1970s with metal detectors. Apparently, the townsfolk had put up a gravestone for this poor Martian who had perished in the mill.
Huh.
And so, yeah, armed with metal detectors, these researchers in the 70s allegedly did recover some of the original metals that were still left below the surface, and it did align with the original reports, that it was aluminum-ish, silver-ish, and that the craft must have weighed several tons because they were able to find, like, a decent amount of chunks of this stuff. But overall, this story is pretty nuts. And the first thing I think of is the, like, the idea that there, that's a lot of material for the townsfolk and locals to have collected.
Hmm.
So where is this metal? Where, like, are there just chunks of this alleged crash scattered around the U.S. on random bookshelves? And
I wonder.
Just in people's garden? I don't even know. Like, whatever people do with rocks they collect.
Maybe. Or maybe there's like a local museum. I wonder if we have any listeners in the area of Aurora, Texas that would be able to share or shed some light on this more local rendition of the Roswell sort of.
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, well, this unknown metal isn't really unknown because it is made of a mixture of aluminum and silver, which I don't know how rare that is in nature itself. Like, could you just have, like, veins of this occurring in a region and then...
It's not as if they have the technology then to do the analysis like we were seeing in the... With Travis.
Oh, no, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Finding all the crazy metals at Skinwalker Ranch or whatever. Mm-hmm. There was allegedly the daughter of this judge who came out years later saying that this was all a hoax.
Okay.
And that the story was published to be a tourism attraction and that the headstone went up later as a tourism attraction.
Hmm.
However, this is kind of rejected in a lot of UFO circles, very much like a lot of later retractions of stories are. One, because apparently it's hard to corroborate if this judge had a daughter. One of the articles I read was like, it was kind of unclear whether he actually did or not. Also, UFO tourism in 1897 is not a thing. You are not trying to attract people to your town by doing that, I don't think.
Unless, think about it this way. Unless, yeah, maybe the judge himself existed, everything existed, maybe his windmill was destroyed randomly in a storm or something, and then it was decades later when another member, like a later generation of his family, decide to just make up this whole story.
Right.
And then basically use it as some sort of, like, way to draw tourism historically, and, like, it didn't even happen in the 1800s. It was like they were thinking this up in the 1940s or 50s, like later on, and then two decades after that, MUFON picks it up in the 70s, and then it kind of continues on from there. That's where I would say maybe there could be some room to make that plausible, but again, the idea, the daughter of J.S. Proctor, she'd have to be pretty freaking old.
Be pretty old.
Like, you'd think it'd be like the granddaughter or something.
Unless she said this in the 40s or 50s, and then, yeah, again, later, the quote comes out later, and it's just very strange. I do think that this can more or less be chalked up to mostly a hoax, but that, again, kind of goes in line with what we're saying with all this in regards to the airship, that there was so many different sightings in different locations that it had to have been, in my opinion, multiple different factors. Mm-hmm. And I do think that we are heading into, this is just a few decades before essentially the beginning of the UFO era that is still just going up and up and up in terms of, like, knowledge to this day in America. And I think that that could be potentially one of the culprits here.
Yeah.
But
did you know that the alien had a name?
I did not. What was his name?
Ned. His name is Ned. This is actually from auroratexas.gov.
I love it.
And it's talking about their community history there. And they're like, the history of, quote, Ned, our alien. And it goes into the whole story.
It's beautiful.
The lore of a cigar-shaped spacecraft crashing into the windmill. J.S. Proctor's named in this article. So there's a lot of fun with this story here.
And absolutely.
Whether or not it's real or not, I love it when towns kind of, like, make these monuments and it just embrace the strange, you know.
Absolutely. And it's sort so of like fun. I mean, yeah, is this just a very, you know, someone taking advantage of the airship craze happening across the country and trying to just tweak it into something different?
Mm-hmm.
It very well could be.
I don't know. They take it pretty seriously. They even have the original here on their website. This is the original newsprint. We should actually post this. Maybe. I don't know how readable it is, but it does have this story, and it was published in April of 1897. So it's not like as if, my original sort of like hypothesis might not be valid then, because like we do have this original article to back. To date the thing.
Yeah, it's just not as if it's an era of peer review. And so it's like, that's what exactly. I think we were getting at there. It's this idea of it's in a newspaper, but how much can we actually believe this stuff?
Right, yeah.
Now, you might be thinking that everyone listening, when it comes to my sort of final theory / the one that I genuinely want this all to be associated with, and I saved it for the end.
Oh, yeah.
Because when we started reading about these stories and researching for these episodes, the idea of craft coming from somewhere else in the sky to me is just so magical. And because these ships were so, like, quote unquote, sort of steampunk, it immediately reminded me of the classic 1980s Japanese anime Castle in the Sky.
Totally. Mm-hmm. I love this.
And then sort of juxtaposed to that, this idea throughout a lot of different paranormal phenomena that there actually is a heck of a lot more going on above us in the skies than we truly understand, whether it be Oregon energy left to be harnessed, whether it be sky beasts that we can't even see coming from God knows where, or whether or not there's potentially gateways to other places in the sky. This has come up a lot. And so I definitely wanted to touch on it, this idea that very much like the cloaked alien craft, maybe this is us from the future. This is us in a way. This is maybe some sort of time slip potentially phenomena where we're seeing craft that is just so close to where we were going to be. But it isn't quite us. It's coming from somewhere else.
Or maybe it's like, it's a page over in the dimensional book, so to speak, where it's like our universes are almost parallel, but somehow there's these little differences.
Could entire other worlds exist directly adjacent to ours? And there's these access points. And, you know, I wasn't really going to go down this path for this episode. I came across this article from a few years ago where it's essentially showing a Chinese city floating in the sky. And immediately reminded me of Castle in the Sky. It's a bizarre video, and we can share this with you guys as well, and you could definitely Google it, even just like City in the Sky, hovering Chinese city. And it essentially shows what looks to be, you know, skyscrapers coming out of the clouds.
Whoa.
And it loosely resembles the city below it in some sort of a Fata Morgana effect, which
I
is the...
I was going to say, is it something like that?
Which I'll touch on in just a moment here. But the reason it was so interesting is because it was so perfect, the way it was caught, that researchers, atmospheric scientists, were amazed because they had never seen something this this perfect in a Fata Morgana effect.
Okay.
But it was also strange because apparently we don't actually see in the video the city, the original city, really.
Yeah.
It kind of just goes up and shows the city in the clouds that seems to be emerging in some sort of sky portal. And it doesn't obviously directly refer to what's below it.
It's basically a trick of the eye where you see things from a distance and they appear to be floating.
Yes.
I can't remember exactly what the principle is associated. It's something to do with those.
So I have it right here. It's cold, dense air near the ground or the surface area where you're looking out, at the top of the water or the ground, and then a layer of warmer air above it. And it creates this visual phenomena where obviously it lifts in your perspective of what you're looking at. And so there's examples of this. Obviously with like the Flying Dutchman, the classic ghost ship, where it very much could have just been actual ships that people are seeing in the distance. It looks like it's flying in the air. We've seen other examples of this where it looks like islands floating in the sky as well, because they're just happen to be in the distance, like a lighthouse that is poking out of a cloud. So that's very much what this could be, but it was just so perfect. And there's this quote from Dr. Peggy Lamon, who's an atmospheric scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. And she's quoted as saying, "This looks almost too good to be true."
It is. Was there any sort of video analysis done on this? Like, I'm talking, do we get Michael Primo on this? Come on. Like, I want to hear some actual, like, breakdown of, like, you know, like, whether or not this could have been fabricated or whether it is just footage shot clean. Like, no.
I didn't get into that.
Meddling.
It definitely doesn't look like CGI outright, but the phenomena just in general is just something interesting to sort of speculate on. This idea that the airships we've discussed have to come from somewhere. And it constantly came up in the stories where, one, nobody knew where they were taking off from, and two, nobody ever saw them land anywhere.
True,
they were always going somewhere. It was just this nebulous and no one ever saw that happen.
That's a great point. The only time we saw a touchdown was with the article that we just mentioned, which may or may not have been related to the original articles from part one,
right?
But the alien story. That's the only time where the craft was on...
Yeah, this is most likely an example of optical illusion, Fata Morgana effect. But it is also fascinating to think that, obviously, yeah, these things had to come from somewhere. They had to go somewhere. And the sightings are, you know, the name Phantom Airship isn't just because nobody knew who was creating it or piloting it. It did seem as if they were sort of coming and going amongst the clouds like phantoms.
Totally. Like, what if they were coming in and out of portals from other dimensions of the world? Like, I'm totally going back to Skinwalker Ranch again, just because it's such a melting pot of all these amazing phenomena and things like that. But I, in particular, there were several encounters or instances where people actually saw what appeared to be a portal to what was daylight going through at night. And that was witnessed by, what was the family name? I can't remember anyways, but the original family that lived on the ranch there. And then there was also the instances from the researchers once NIDS was on the scene where they saw with their like night vision goggles, they actually saw something that appeared to be like a Bigfoot-like creature emerge from one of these portals. So there's things coming and going. And like, what if these airships are kind of, again, like tied up with that somehow? Or it could even be like a Lost World situation where there's so many different realms and dimensions. They might not even be coming from the same place. Well,
exactly. I mean, here's the thing. We've talked about some wild stuff in this part too. And obviously that last story, a little bit of a grain of salt, but portals, we do know, we know, you and I both know, I think the people listening know that portals exist. What we don't understand them exactly, but they do exist. And we're starting to see more corroborating evidence to obviously show that this is very real.
We're seeing data. And I'm talking, I'm going back Travis. And I was so compelled. We still need to cover this on the show because that last season of Skinwalker Ranch, which premiered last, what was it, summer, fall?
Yeah.
Into the fall. But they, at the end of that season, they were literally compiling data that was very compelling to me and looked as if they were actually like mapping an invisible portal that's above that triangle area.
Yes.
That's where a lot of the phenomena associated. And I'm just,
absolutely. So we're bouncing, we're bouncing around a bit here, but it all comes back together for the thesis here, because that is essentially what we're getting at. Is it possible that these phantom airships were test flights coming from another place? Or if we wanted to touch on back to the Samuel Hagen, was this an entirely earthly creation that simply got lost? You just mentioned Lost World. If you guys aren't familiar with that show, it's a classic from the 1990s, super cheesy, but it's also really fun. Yeah, and they are in a hot air balloon and they get lost. Right? And it's like there's hundreds of different worlds and they can't escape. They're just perpetually caught in this sort of limbo,
this kaleidoscope state. Exactly that, where people come and go and all of a sudden you turn a corner in the woods and all of a sudden you're in medieval Europe. Or you're somewhere else and dinosaurs flying around. There's all sorts of crazy stuff.
So could poor Samuel Hagen have, you know, flown into some electronic fog and found himself, you know, perpetually trapped in the sky? Who knows? But that is definitely where we wanted to kind of end our theory section for the episode today, because the idea of just a sky realm is absolutely just so cool. Yeah. I really want Castle in the Sky to actually exist, obviously. Man, just awesome. Yeah, final thoughts. We would love to hear what you guys think about all this, what you believe the Phantom Airships were. So definitely comment on our next Instagram post or send us an email and hit us up.
Or on Spotify, I guess. Hey,
Spotify, you can
do the whole, commenting on there. That's pretty cool.
Totally. I don't think you can leave a written review on Spotify, but you can click the 5 stars. So again, 5-star reviews. Man, thank you guys so much for those and keep them coming. We really appreciate it.
We really do.
And maybe we can get back to doing some of the, we used to read some reviews back in the old days. Aww, maybe if you guys wanted us to give you direct name shout outs, we could do that again too. But shout outs right now. Massive thank you to our producers, Adam Kellums and Kitsune. You two are incredible. And then also, again, a thank you to Adam Benedict for his amazing work with Oddities in Print, Ghosts in Print, and Monsters in Print. Yes. It's a series. It's incredible. Go check it out on Amazon and order all three. Mm-hmm. Definitely a must-have for the paranormal bookshelf.
Yes.
And we do have a new Patreon episode in the works. Really excited about it. We're going to be delving into some of the darkness of H.P. Lovecraft, alleged accounts with entities that resemble some of the monsters from his stories, and also some interesting sort of philosophy on comparative religion discussing whether or not these dark gods might in some way be real.
Mm-hmm.
Gets pretty interesting.
It's fascinating. I can't wait to get into that one.
Yeah. Hit us up. Follow us on Instagram at Into the Portal Podcast. Not really on Twitter anymore. Not calling it X, but we're on there at Into the Portal 1. Yeah. Hit us up on there. And if you don't already, follow us on Dark Artifacts as well, at Dark Artifacts on Instagram. It's still a slow go, but that is still pending, and we can't wait to show you guys more with that.
Totally. Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this two-part series on the Phantom Alien Airship, or, well, just Phantom Airships, I guess.
Ooh, potentially. Potentially.
we definitely go down that angle. You know, you're listed into the portal, so.
Indeed.
Yeah. No. We appreciate you all so, so much. Just big shout-out to everyone that's still around after the many years that we've been doing this.
The many, many years, that's true. And many years to come, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So, thank you all so much, and until next time on Into the Portal.
Your gateway to the bizarre.